And Senator Gordley, I don't know if you want to lead off or if Sean wants to.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, I am Avelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Portland. And with me is my constituent, Sean Cruz, who also serves as my legislative assistant. And it is his experience with the subject of parental abductions which brings this piece of legislation before you. What I would like to do before turning the microphone over to Sean Cruz to allow him to share his experience is just walk you through some of the materials you have in front of you. First of all, I would like to thank Mickey Cerise, who is Special Assistant for Children, Adults, and Families in the Oregon Department of Human Services. It was Mr. Cerise who worked with us to help us narrow the focus of our legislation and to focus on the creation of a task force to explore the incidence of parental abductions in Oregon. This is, in fact, a national issue. So our thanks to Mickey Cerise. I also would like to just read from a letter from the Department of Human Services regarding Senate Bill 578, which clarifies that the bill before you creates a task force to explore issues related to abduction of children by parents. The department, although they believe the proposed legislation is good public policy, they are unable to support the bill because of a small fiscal impact. And I'd like to make it very clear that that small fiscal impact is less than $1,000. And because that $1,000 is not included in the governor's recommended budget, the department is unable to support the bill. But again, they make the point that they believe this proposed legislation is good public policy.
Senator Gordon, I just want to say for the record in the ears of the governor's office that that is the dumbest and most inane policy that I've ever encountered. The fact that an agency can work with a senator to develop what they consider to be good policy or issue a public statement that they cannot support it because of the fiscal impact that's less than $5,000 or even $25,000. It's absolutely stupid in my opinion because it's clear to me that we should be working together. And once the governor's budget, which is a fluid document anyway, first exists, we ought to be working together to develop that. We've had this happen in this committee before where agencies come in and say, oh, gee whiz, we think it might be a good idea, however, comma. Frankly, I think that's bad public policy, and I think the governor's office and the agencies ought to be working with the legislature to accommodate that without these inane, rather silly letters that are statements in opposition. That's my personal opinion. And share that for the record and in the ears of the governor.
I appreciate very much the sentiments of the chair. And again, also appreciate very much the support that we have received from the Department of Human Services. The letter before you, which is dated May 16th, shares some information with you about the scope of the problem. Parental abductions of children is, in fact, a national problem. Family members, including parents, abducted over 200,000 children in 1999. And as a result of parental abductions, a parent is prevented from seeing his or her children even when court orders specify contact parameters and visitation time. Children and their families suffer from these abductions. In some circumstances, children grow up and miss the opportunity to bond with one parent. You'll hear more from Sean Cruz about what the impact of that experience can have on a parent and children. Senate Bill 578A creates an experienced task force membership to look into this problem as it relates to Oregon and to recommend strategies to reduce the incidence of parental abductions. And Mr. Chair and members, what you have in your packet is the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 578. These amendments replace the bill. These amendments reflect the language that was suggested to us, recommended to us by the Department of Human Services. You will also find in your packet, we've done a great deal of research in our office. I should say Sean Cruz has done a great deal of research on the subject of parental abduction. And so what we provided to you in your packet are materials from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which lay out the scope of the problem nationally, materials that also enlighten us, you, about the psychological issues in recovery and family reunification, issues regarding the impact of abduction on children. The point that we're making here is that there's a great deal of research out there that tells us what harm is done to children and families in the case of parental abductions. You will also find in your packet an editorial that goes back to August of 1996. It was an Oregonian editorial entitled Say Yes for Kids. And at that time, they were writing about the Family Law Task Force, the Oregon Family Law Task Force, and some of its recommendations around halting the sabotage of parents' child visitation rights. That Oregonian editorial also referenced the situation that Sean Cruz had just experienced. At that time, his children had just disappeared unannounced with his ex-wife, and I guess he'll go into the details of that story. So again, we hope that the materials that you have in front of you will help to enlighten you about the scope of the problem nationally. Again, we know that in Oregon we also have a problem with parental abductions. And we believe that the task force, the establishment of a task force, will help us determine what next steps might be required in Oregon. I would point out that the work of the task force is time limited. The task force would complete its work by the next legislative session, making a report to the next legislative session. And in fact, the task force would be repealed after February 1 of 2005. With that said, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Sean Cruz.
Mr. Cruz.
Thank you. Chair Minnis, committee members, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz. I am Senator Avell Gordley's legislative assistant, and I want to thank her for support and encouragement, and most of all, her willingness to listen to the issue and understand. I'm the father of four children who disappeared in a parental abduction on February 12, 1996. Their names are Natalia Cruz, Aaron Cruz, Tyler Cruz, and Allie Cruz. This abduction was planned at least 3 months in advance and carried out by my former wife and as many as a dozen people in three states. My kids were taken from Hillsboro, Oregon. They were taken out of school in Hillsboro, Oregon, and to the best of my knowledge, to Battleground, Washington, then back here to Salem, then to the Oregon coast, then to Idaho, and then to a series of places in the mountains east of Ogden, Utah. All of these movements occurred over a period of weeks and months while their former friends and classmates were in school. My children are presently in or near Provo, Utah, except for my son Aaron, who returned home to me last Saturday. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 578, which the Department of Human Services believes is good public policy. Because of a small fiscal impact, they are unable to support the bill. Thank you. Senate Bill 578 creates a task force to explore issues related to the abduction of children by parents. This bill addresses a serious problem that exists in public policy and in Oregon statute. I would like to give the committee some background information about me, about the public policy issues surrounding parental abduction, and about what distinguishes a parental abduction from a custody issue. I will then explain the Dash 1 amendments that replace the bill. Professionally, I'm a realtor. I'm also a Portland Police Bureau volunteer, serving on the crisis response team for the past 5 years, working with the families of homicide victims. I've been a volunteer for the Department of Justice, also for 5 years, serving on the U.S. Attorney's Weed and Seed Steering Committee in Portland, and was a founding director of the National Organization of Weed and Seed, representing the Pacific Northwest in Washington, D.C. Let me just say that weed and seed is not an agricultural issue. It's about weeding out violent criminals and drug dealers and seeding in community development. I have also been a volunteer and board member for 2 women's domestic violence organizations in Portland, serving Spanish-speaking women and families escaping domestic violence, and I'm an active member of Victory Outreach Church. Before my 4 children disappeared 7 years and 4 months ago, I'd been a Little League baseball and softball coach for 8 years. I was a joint custodial parent who saw my kids an average of 180 days each year during the 5 years that followed our divorce in 1991. My divorce decree states that I'm a fit and proper parent. It spells out specifically the days and times in which my kids had residential time with me. Residential time with me. And lays out a formula for special days and holidays. My decree states that all major decisions regarding the children are to be made by both parents together. My former wife committed a felony and was charged with custodial interference in the first degree when she took our children out of school without my knowledge or consent, when she changed the children's residence without notifying me of their destination, and when she took the children out of state in violation of a valid joint custodial order. 5 months after the abduction, she was indicted by a grand jury and charged with first-degree custodial interference in Washington County. In April 1997, although she had been in continual violation of this valid joint custody order for more than a year and was still hiding the children in Utah, she was found not guilty of the crime. Members of her family and their associates committed crimes when they, I'm reading from ORS 163.257, caused the person taken, enticed, or kept from the lawful custodian or in violation of a valid joint custody order to be removed from the state. This is a Class B felony. None of these people were ever charged. To the best of my knowledge, the statute of limitations ran out on these crimes more than 4 years ago. And I'm talking about the people, the criminals, who participated in and aided the abduction of my 4 children. Chair Minnis and members of the committee, I am, first and above all these other things that describe my life, a father. That was and is the most important thing about my character and what motivates me to get up in the morning and try to have a good day. Since my children's abduction, I have survived clinical depression, job loss, I said multiple job loss, hunger, homelessness, hopelessness, despair to the point of considering suicide, and thousands of bleak, empty days and nights. I have felt, and continue to feel, my pain, the pain of my late mother. I never saw grandchildren again, and the pain of my absent children in the way that a parent suffers when his or her child suffers. I continue to suffer insomnia, frequent nightmares in which I'm searching for a missing child, depression, memory loss, and other symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Additionally, I live surrounded by events and occurrences that trigger both memories of the trauma and which highlight the loss that has occurred. My church family at Victory Outreach has helped to carry and pray me through all of this. I've spent the last 6 years rebuilding my life. For the victims of parental abduction, for the children themselves, for the left-behind parents, as that is what we are called, and for the other family members who are cut off in a parental abduction, and they have no standing and are completely ignored, there are no advocates. There are no support groups. There are no lawyers willing to take on your case. You call a lawyer, and they immediately categorize the kidnapping as a domestic issue, as some extreme form of visitation dispute when it is about the abuse of your child. Parental abduction is child abuse. I say these things because parental abductions are so broadly misunderstood, so trivialized in the minds of both the public and the law enforcement bodies that the left behind family turns to, and turns to in vain. My four children disappeared in the middle of a major rainstorm in February of 1996, and it never even made the news. 7 months later, there was an editorial in the Oregonian titled Say Yes for Kids, which referred to my children's abduction and which recognized the harm done in these situations. Nationwide, about 250,000 children are abducted by family members each year, as documented by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and other sources. According to staff at the Department of Human Services, approximately 2,800 Oregon children are abducted each year. The number of children that are abducted from other states and brought to Oregon is unknown. I'd like to make a comment about what a parental abduction is. Research shows us that for abducted children, all relationships are severed at the point of the kidnapping. Many are required to assume new identities. One consequence of this is the inability to form intimate, trusting relationships throughout the remainder of their lives, which is also a well-understood result of sexual abuse. Research tells us that abducted children are forced or groomed by their abductors to disregard or even despise their parent, and this is child abuse. Research also tells us that, in addition to the losses of parent, family, and friends that the child suffers, the abduction is likely to create additional problems for the child at school and in gaining new friends. How does the child explain the absence of the missing parent? Does the child understand that the abductor's story explaining the absence is true or false? And how does the child feel in the company of intact families? Public policy for children stolen in family abductions does not recognize the grievous harm that the children and their families suffer. This is a point that I ask you to remember. My children, for example, lost their dad, an entire side of their extended family and its heritage, all of their friends, both of their homes, the one with me and the one with their mother, their school, their neighborhood, all at once. In the subsequent moving from place to place that their kidnappers put them through, they suffered these losses again and again. This is much, much more than bad judgment on the part of a parent. This is child abuse. Research tells us that abducted children are also not permitted by their abductors to go through a normal process of grieving their losses. This results in long-term emotional harm. Now, I'd like to refer to Exhibit A in your packet. This document, titled Psychological Issues in Recovery and Family Reunification, is available on the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's website. The authors are experts from the Western Center for Child Protection and the Center for the Study of Trauma. This article describes the psychological issues involved, makes recommendations for the initial reunification, and describes psychological issues after reunification. In my 7.5 years of experience as a parent of kidnapped children, this article and the one that follows are among the most useful pieces of information I have encountered in laying out the case that a parental abduction is not a custody issue but a criminal issue, and that the harm to the child, even in abductions of short duration, is extensive and long-lasting. One of the chief barriers to the reunification of abducted children is the attitude, reflected in Oregon public policy and statute, that parental abduction is only about custody. While custody may be an issue in some cases, ultimately parental abduction is about the abuse of a child. This is an issue that needs to be more closely studied for public policy remedy in the state of Oregon, one that affects many families. That is at the crux of why are we asking for a creation of a task force on parental abductions through Senate Bill 578. The authors state that most recovered children struggle with guilt and shame around the abduction event. If the child is aware that he or she was being abducted, the child frequently feels responsible for not seeking help or calling home. Further, when the child realizes that the abducting parent's statements about the left-behind parent were not true, the child feels guilty for not having seen this earlier. In a few cases, the child truly does not understand what happened and yet feels responsible for not having known. After recovery, children are often caught in conflicting loyalty demands. It is inhuman and inhumane to put a child through the agony of choosing one parent and rejecting the other. The SETI notes that while every abduction is unique, the longer the abduction proceeds, the more difficult the process of reunification. Exhibit B, the impact of abduction on children, a study of 371 cases, is also from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's website. In 21% of the cases, children were taken to other countries and subjected to a new culture while hiding. In recent weeks, a 5-year-old girl who was abducted from her mother 2 years ago was reunited to Eugene, returned to Eugene. The little girl had been kept in a hut in the jungles of Costa Rica. How can anyone suggest that this little girl was not abused and that the damage to this family will not go on for many years? I can state from personal experience that once you have gone through the trauma of having a child missing for an extended period of time, you will never be the same. You will never be whole, even after that child is found, and neither will that child. In the study, Exhibit B, 23% of these children were reported as physically abused, 7% were sexually abused, 5% both physically and sexually abused. To quote, it says, children were exposed to a range of other abusive behaviors, such as being screamed at, threatened, and witnessed to adult-to-adult fighting. I want to point out that those happen after the abduction. The study also notes that younger children may be abducted at a time when crucial development bonds are being formed with a searching parent. Such a break may result in serious emotional problems at the time or in the future. Overall functioning was believed to have declined in more than half of the children between the time they were taken from and returned to the searching parent. Chair Minnis, members of the committee, Senate Bill 578 is intended to build upon the work of the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, which began its work 10 years ago in the 1993 legislature. Its mission was to recommend the best and least adversarial family conflict resolution system that it could develop for families in the process of divorce. Its final report stated that, and I quote, too often children were treated like property. Some parents misused the adversarial process to damage the relationship between the other parent and the child. The task force heard a great deal of evidence that such anger and conflict severely injured children. On page one of the final report, titled A Message to the Governor and the Legislature, William Howe III, chairman of the task force, wrote, the evidence is now overwhelming that children do best when they are nurtured and receive emotional and financial support from both parents. Parental conflict is harmful to children, and conflict during divorce is the most injurious. Among the public policy statements the task force developed include, children need predictable, conflict-free time with both parents. To promote the same policy objective, the task force also recommended and the legislature passed legislation requiring that among the factors a court must consider in making custody decisions is the willingness and ability of each of the parents to facilitate and encourage a close and continuing parent-child relationship between the child and the other parent. This task force recommendations are also cited in the Oregonian's Say Yes for Kids editorial from August 1996, which is in your packet. This proposed task force on parental abduction will identify the scope of the problem in Oregon in numbers and in the harm that results. The task force will study and evaluate strategies to reduce the incidence of parental abductions in this state, and when they do occur, find methods to resolve parental abductions in a manner that serves in the best interests of the child and the child's family. In closing, I want to call the committee's attention to the photograph in your packets. A year ago, I attempted a walk from Vancouver, Washington to southern Utah to call attention to the issue of parental abductions and to send a message to my kids that no matter what they've been led to believe, their father still loves them and will not give up the battle. I decided to walk because I felt that I'd tried every other means without success. I was only able to walk as far as the other side of Pendleton before my body wore out. I walk for my kids and for all the other parents and families who have been left behind and for all of those other stolen kids. Just last Saturday, one of my children returned home after 7 years. I want to say that his arms are covered with more than 30 self-inflicted knife wounds that occurred in the 2 years since he was stolen. And I understand that one of my daughters also was self-mutilating in that same period. So my other three children remain isolated, incommunicado, have no way to contact them. They're confused, they're angry, and they're in the exclusive control of their abductors. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 578 out of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cruz. Any questions? We have the committee.
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank you for joining me in co-sponsoring Senate Bill 578. And I would also like to thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for listening to Sean's testimony this morning and allowing us to lay out a record, a clear record of what the issues are and why there is a need for this task force in Oregon. We thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. No questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Just a comment. I mean, I know you've just been through things that nobody should have to go through, but your criterion is doing absolutely everything you can, and knowing in your heart that you've done everything you can, I think your presence here today and what we're about to do with this bill should make you feel at peace with that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Everybody has reviewed the Nash 1 Amendment. Work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move the Nash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 578.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Nash 1 Amendments to Senate Bill 578. Discussion on the motion. Is there any objection to the motion?
Yes.
No objection? Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 578 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 578 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, want to thank Mr. Cruz and Senator Gordley for bringing this forward. And I passed you a note and told you that I thought your committee would agree with you about the position of agencies who can't support a bill because it's not in the governor's recommended budget. I find that ridiculous, particularly when the fiscal impact is less than $1,000 for clearly an issue that is a very serious issue for Oregon families and Oregon's children. And I just hope that we can get this bill through the process.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments, questions? There are none. Any objections to the motion? No objection. Passes. Senator Gordley, I assume you'd like to carry this bill.
And I will hope that you will carry it with me, Mr. Chair.
We'll add a few comments. Yes, we will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on now to House Bill 2694. Council, when you're ready.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2694, if you recall, we heard a couple weeks ago, it deals with obligations between suppliers and retailers of farm implements, specifically what happens when the retailer either goes out of business, moves, what happens to the inventory, what gets bought back, what happens when the manufacturer, the supplier, has additional the changes to deal with a product defect or adds new new equipment. It's my understanding that there's a small dash A4 amendment that I believe Sean Miller is going to speak on very quickly. Otherwise, the bill should be ready to move forward at this time. Last time we actually heard the bill, I think this amendment was mentioned. It was still in the process of being drafted.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent here today on behalf of Caterpillar, the world's leader in heavy equipment and engine manufacturing. We were Caterpillar was a participant along with John Deere and Case New Holland, which are farm implement manufacturers, in the negotiations of the elements within 2694. Current law regulates, as Mr. Joseph indicated, the relationship between equipment dealers and manufacturers. It was enacted in 1993 with lengthy negotiations and discussions among the dealers and manufacturers and legislative leaders. House Bill 2694 amends those 93 laws. It, too, is a result of negotiations and discussions among the dealers and manufacturers. Real briefly on the amendment before I turn it over to Ron to discuss the bill. During the bill drafting on the House side, several parts of the existing law were redrafted, even though there was no proposed changes to those sections from the manufacturers and the dealers. In all instances but one, the intent of the new language is the same as the old. In the one case, however, we are concerned that the rewritten version may be interpreted differently than intended, and therefore the A4 amendments, specifically referring to Section 5, Subsection 2 and 3, are proposed. Again, that just take back to existing law and does not change anything in the current law. We're requesting those corrective or clarifying amendments to be sure that the intent of the law does not change, and we believe the Pacific Northwest Association that represents the dealers is fine with the amendment. And this time, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Ron to discuss the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Ron.
Good morning, Chairman Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Ron Moore. I'm president of Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association. We're a trade association representing the farm equipment dealers in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. The bill before you amends the current statutes. Farm equipment dealers operate on a dealer agreement between the dealer and the manufacturer. They are not a franchise. And basically what happens is the manufacturer drafts the agreement, presents it to the dealer, and he either signs it or he doesn't sign it. Now, a little background, a few years back, if the dealer was not satisfied with the agreement, he may reject the agreement and sign a contract with Oliver or Massey or whomever. But today, due to consolidations of both the manufacturers and the dealers, you know, you have John Deere, Case New Holland, which represents New Holland and Case, and AGCO, and that is your four major manufacturers of farm equipment in the world. So there's not a lot of options left for the equipment dealer. So if he's not too satisfied with the contract, it becomes a little difficult. So the provisions of this bill sort of level the playing field for the dealer. Upon termination, it defines termination for good cause, in which the manufacturer can terminate the dealer for good cause. It also provides termination for other than good cause, in which the manufacturer would have to give the dealer 60 days notice, 90 days provisions to cure, and it regulates the relationship upon termination for buyback of the whole goods and parts. It defines the manufacturer's responsibility upon warranty situations. Currently today, the manufacturers may not pay the dealer's going labor rate, and that makes it a little hard for the dealer to honor the warranty work. It talks to the succession of the dealership and the rights of the dealer. And it also defines the contract as being oral or written. And with me this morning is Burl Scheibe with the Fisher Ernst Group out of the St. Paul store. Burl is here to answer if you have any specific questions about how a dealership may operate. I thought it might be nice to have a dealer answer those for you. I'd be glad to answer any other questions you may have regarding the bill. I might just make one final comment. The provisions in this bill are not exactly the same, but close to the same that we passed in the state of Washington. It took us 2 years of negotiating with the manufacturers to come to terms of agreement. And with regards to Sean's amendment, we don't have any objections to that amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add.
Yes.
I think I might have misspoke. We've heard this bill twice in the House, and I guess it wasn't heard here before.
Yeah, we had it on the agenda, but I don't think we
I was looking for my notes.
So I apologize for that. But this is legislation that I understand is being passed in Western states beyond Washington, and is basically represents a consensus agreement between the manufacturers, suppliers, and the dealers.
I want to ask a question about the A4 amendment. It says on page 9 line 5, and this is a small thing, but maybe significant. It says delete the fifth comma. I only count 4 commas, so I'm trying to find out which comma we're supposed to be deleting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a good question. They might be...
I got it.
There is.
Hang on, there is. This is like one of those, do you see the defect?
Yeah.
Okay, there are 5. After.
Yeah.
One after cause, one after supplier, one after officer, one after employee, and one after may. So it would be the one. All right, the one. That would be the one. Okay, good. All right, I'm not going crazy. Or perhaps I'm
that there.
The jury is still out. Okay. All right. Well, since we haven't had a full-fledged public hearing on this, is there additional information that you want to share with us? This, I assume, is a model act? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Mr. Joseph indicated, as a national manufacturers, and we work these agreements out with the dealers, it's something that we want to keep uniform in most of the states. It is being passed in most of the states. Ron is working in a lot of the western states. It's similar language, and that's why we like to keep the language very similar. And again, it was passed in Washington, and we urge the committee to adopt the revisions here in Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will add that in the House, the manufacturers and the suppliers did not appear in opposition, and they don't appear to be here today.
Right. And usually, if you're doing any kind of damage at all, they show up in droves.
They did in Washington.
They did?
Yeah. This bill is not contentious at this point, but we did struggle for 2 years in the state of Washington to get to a point where we could agree. So you get the benefit of that.
Well, that's very nice. We like that. All right, committee, what do you think? Want more information?
Explain
us a little bit what's relating to cause. No,
well, my sister, Mr. Chair, my sister's recently ex-in-laws own the John Deere franchise in Woodburn, and I would have liked to have called him, but we have the dealers here. You, sir, are a dealer. You didn't get to speak, but I assume...
You're welcome.
We like this bill, and everybody's on board. I still like my sister's ex-in-laws, by the way. Their son is just a little bit of a twit.
Well, on behalf of most all the implement dealers, and I can give you some specifics that relate to our particular dealership that this bill will correct. A couple years ago, we had a situation.
Can you name again?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Verl Scheibe. I'm the manager of Ernst Hardware in St. Paul, a John Deere dealership, and part of a principal in the Fisher Ernst Group. We have dealerships all up and down the valley. And in our particular organization, a couple of years ago, we had, and as it turned out, an oral agreement with one of our suppliers. It was not one of our major suppliers, but one of our, we call, short line suppliers that supply other brands that we sell also. The agreement was that we would act as a kind of a warehouse for them. And as it turned out, they didn't honor their agreement. We ended up having to pay for all of this stuff, which originally we were just supposed to store it. It cost us thousands of dollars. This bill would eliminate that because it would include oral agreements as part of this bill.
Okay.
And that would be applicable to all dealerships. And then in addition to that, it also addresses some of the warranty issues, particularly under safety, product improvements, where the manufacturers would have to pay us for travel. Currently, under any or all warranties, there's no provisions for paying us for our travel time. And or in a lot of the suppliers, particularly, again, not referring to the major suppliers, because they do pay us our regular shop rate for warranty. A lot of the outside manufacturer short line suppliers do not. They tell us what they will pay us for our warranty work. And in most cases, does not even come close to covering our costs. This bill would correct that. And in safety issues, our major suppliers do pay us most of the time for travel. When it comes to safety modifications or improvements, this bill would require all of our suppliers, including the short line suppliers, to pay us for travel time if it's specific for a safety improvement. There have been some instances in the past where that hasn't happened, and as a result, dealers have to incur all of that on their own responsibility, and that should come from some of the manufacturers also.
All right.
Thank
all
right.
you.
Mr. Cecil.
Madam Vice Chair.
Senator Burdick. Dash-4 amendments to House Bill 2694.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of Dash-4 amendments. A-4 amendments. Is it Dash-4? A-4 amendments to 2694. Discussion? Objections?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 2694 as amended to the Senate floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2694 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? There's no objection. Motion. Thank you very much. And Senator Starr, can you carry this?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. The next exciting issue will be eminent domain. House Bill 3370, public hearing, council. Would you share with us a little?
Sure. The next three bills, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, are eminent domain bills. Essentially, there are a series of law improvement bills dealing with the law of eminent domain. That is when a municipality or government entity needs to take a portion of somebody's land. The most common example that you're familiar with is during the I-5 expansion. The land was needed to expand I-5 from essentially a two-lane road to the four-lane highway that we see today. They would take pieces of the farmland on either side. They would pay a reasonable compensation to the owners of that farmland for the portion that was taken. The first bill, as it says, simply consolidates the laws into one area. Currently, the law is spread out in various areas. And then from there, we've got two more bills that have more substantive changes. And it's my understanding that Wendy Johnson from the Law Commission is here, and she may have some other witnesses that she wants to bring up.
All right, Wendy. Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. In 2001, the Oregon Law Commission authorized the creation of an eminent domain work group to address ambiguities in eminent domain statutory provisions and to look at several law reform areas. The work group was chaired by Oregon Law Commissioner Greg Mouse, to my right. He's a partner at Stoll Reeves Law Firm, and his practice emphasizes condemnation and business litigation. He was appointed to the Oregon Law Commission by the Oregon State Bar. The work group on this eminent domain project included several attorneys in private practice representing condemnors and condemnees. The work group also included state attorneys, state agency representatives, city attorneys, an appraiser, a federal judge, and a representative from the state court administrator's office. During the interim, the work group focused its attention both on a technical review and a cleanup of the existing eminent domain procedural chapter, as well as several substantive reform areas. Three bills were produced. The three bills before you today were originally one bill. The text is the same as that was recommended by the Oregon Law Commission, but we broke it up during session because of relating clause issues. The original bill was pre-session filed and comes to you with the recommendation of the Law Commission. Originally, they were all consensus bills, and as of a few minutes ago, we believe they are, again, all three consensus bills. The Law Commission does have explanatory reports for each of the three bills, and we've distributed those to you ahead of time. We'll submit them again today for the written record. I will turn it out to Oregon Law Commissioner Greg Mao to explain the first of the three bills. It is the simplest of the trilogy.
Thank you. Chair Menace, members of the committee, House Bill 3370 is simply a cleanup bill. At the present time, the bulk of the eminent domain provisions in the Oregon statutes are found in Chapter 35 and Chapter 281. The bulk of them are in Chapter 35, and with the consolidation, all of them would be in Chapter 35. One of the reasons for doing this is that it is not unusual for practitioners who are unfamiliar with eminent domain to handle eminent domain cases, and it is a service to them, at least, to have all the statutes in a single location. There are some other cleanups in the language of Chapter 281, which were performed by Dave Hendricks, just in the process of updating and using consistent wording with current statutory style, but no substantive changes were intended or made.
Are there any questions on that first bill?
Yeah, why don't you just talk to us in general about eminent domain and particularly the Federal Act as referenced here. Help us put it in context. We're not experts in eminent domain, so why don't you give us a little class on it.
Sure. Eminent domain is the inherent power of state government to acquire private property upon payment of just compensation. That power has been delegated by the state through various statutory provisions. Those statutory provisions are found in the statutes that govern separate municipal, county, special district legislation. And for those entities that do have condemnation power, and not all do, they are required to follow a uniform procedure. Uniform procedure is found in Chapter 35 predominantly, with a small portion in Chapter 281. Chapter 281 historically has dealt with the pre-condemnation inspection. It also deals with relocation requirements. Oregon has adopted the Federal Relocation Act, at least for purposes of guidance on required payments to property owners or tenants who are required to relocate as a result of condemnation. Chapter 35 sets out a procedure for condemnation, and generally the order is that before a condemnation may proceed, the governing body must adopt a resolution authorizing the condemnation. There will be an inspection of the property, an appraisal of the property, and prior to filing of a condemnation, there must be an attempt at negotiation, which includes an offer, a formal written offer sent at least 40 days before the condemnation is filed. That offer must be accompanied by the appraisal on which the government relies. At the end of the offer period, the condemnor may file a condemnation action. And upon filing the condemnation action, if there are circumstances requiring an immediate possession of the property in order to accomplish a project that has some time sensitivity, the condemnor can obtain an order of immediate possession. And that is done by making a deposit of the amount of just compensation. Defenses can be raised by a property owner at that time. Defenses can also be raised by the property owner to the right to take, although that's relatively rare. And then ultimately a jury sets the value, and the jury trial comes up in the normal trial docket. The jury determines the amount of just compensation. At that point, the condemnor can either abandon the condemnation, pay all the attorney's fees, and walk away, or in the usual case, deposit the amount, the full amount awarded by the jury into court, at which point the court will enter a judgment that operates to convey title.
Senator, there you go.
The provision for attorney fees is that if the government entity, if the defendant receives at least one penny more than was offered by the government entity, then all attorney fees are awarded.
That's correct.
And isn't it almost always the case that attorney fees are awarded because the defendant is able to obtain an appraisal that's greater than what the government entity had, and therefore the jury kind of looks at the two appraisals and maybe splits things in the middle?
Senator Ringo, that's a good a good question. The juries do, as a practical matter, tend to look and to some degree compromise between appraisals that appear to them to be competent. But that doesn't automatically mean that the property owner recovers attorney's fees, because attorney's fees are based upon what's called a 30-day offer, which I'm sorry I didn't cover earlier. I should have. There's a requirement under Chapter 35 that at least 30 days before trial, the condemner has to make a final written offer of just compensation. And that's the number that the condemnee has to beat in order to recover attorney's fees. So in a condemnation case, sort of the gamesmanship between the attorneys is trying to figure out what a jury is going to do. The condemnor wants to offer enough money that the jury won't come in higher because the attorney's fees are a significant issue. As a practical matter, that mechanism tends to settle a lot of cases because it requires, before trial, a very realistic offer of what's likely to be awarded. And that offer will usually be higher than the condemnor's own appraisal. It'll be usually somewhere in the middle.
They build in a factor for the competing appraisal.
Yes. Yes, and it's a in essence that becomes the bargaining process that pre-condemnation offer.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I have not done a lot of real estate work or appraisal work. I have heard that it's not too hard to obtain a pretty aggressive appraisal. The person that's paying for the appraisal has kind of the leverage to get a good strong appraisal that might really be a little higher than the market would reflect. I was just wondering whether you think that's accurate.
Senator Ringo, there's been, I think historically, that has certainly been sort of common wisdom. I think if it were ever true, it is less true now because of fairly stringent requirements that apply to the appraisal profession. The fact that all appraisers must deliver all appraisals in writing, and all of them are subject to review by a state appraisal certification board, and it is not uncommon for appraisers who issue what might be considered to be out of the norm appraisals to be reported as a result of a condemnation case.
So be reported
to the appraisal, I believe it's the certification board, or there is a state agency which reviews appraisers. And I think my own experience is that, if I could find a few more of those people, I might be happy, but I have not had great success in doing so. I think they're pretty, generally pretty competent.
I see. Okay. I guess just one more. I'm all in favor of attorney fees, but I do, I guess I would like to know that this has been crafted to, so that it does lead to resolution and so that it doesn't allow defendants to unduly extort attorney fees from government entities.
Okay. Senator Ringo, I believe that the current mechanism is very effective in that, because if the government condemning body makes a responsible offer, the property owner is simply incurring additional fees out of its own pocket to fight it. So, there is always the issue of, what's motivating attorneys, but we actually have a pretty good mechanism that creates a moment of truth, that you either, if you can't beat that offer, you are not doing a good job for your client, because you're just burning fees out of their pocket, not the government's pocket. So I think most attorneys would agree with me that that mechanism has served Oregon pretty well. I think it's, and most cases do settle before trial. There's not a huge number that are tried.
Thank you very much.
Do we know how many of these kind of proceedings there are each year in Oregon?
I don't. The single biggest condonor in the state of Oregon is ODOT, and there is an attorney here in the audience who, Al Deppenbrock, who represents ODOT, who might be able to give a better answer than that.
Well, I don't know if Senator Ringo, sounds like we wouldn't agree. It almost seems to me that we ought to pay attorney's fees. I take very seriously when the government steps in and takes personal property or real property from a private citizen. It almost seems to me that attorney's fees ought to be granted by statute rather than having to go through some dance to get them. Because, frankly, I'm very much a private property rights person. And the government comes in and says, John, I want your home. We're going to run a highway through your neighborhood. It's not just the value of the property that's being affected. It's also my relationship to the property that maybe I've spent years investing my time and energy into making my home. And then for the government to come in and say, here's a sterile appraisal of what we think the value of your property is and all of the other relationship that you might have in terms of your interest in the property are just pushed aside, seems rather silly to me. And when the government steps in and takes property, it is as significant as taking someone's liberty away from them.
Well, I Senator Minnis, I understand the point. I think the present statute does to some extent even the playing field with the ability of an owner to recover fees. There are two circumstances where you can get the fees. One is if you beat the offer, and the second is if the initial offer were deemed to be a bad faith offer.
Although, except it seems rather unfair to me. You've got some private property owner who the government's interested in taking the property. Suddenly they're served with a notice that their property is going to be condemned. They go out and hire an attorney from a, if they get to that point, because there's clearly a lot of confusion. What do I do? How do I respond? Do I need an attorney? Do I not need an attorney? So you hire somebody in a prominent firm, and they're charging $300 an hour or more for their work. Those bills pile up pretty quick. So unless that property owner is prepared to deal with the trauma of this thing going on and on and on, it seems to me that the government generally has the upper hand in all of these instances.
Senator Minnis, I think obviously the power of condemnation is a very significant power, and I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of the current statute requires a phased negotiation, requires delivery of the appraisal. And I think part of that amendment was in 97 that required the appraisal to be delivered, and part of the reason was to give the condemnee or the property owner better information to work with. But I certainly recognize your point.
How often do local governments use this power?
Local governments use it less than state governments, generally in connection with specific projects, street widenings, public facilities for sewer or water. The city of Portland, which I do some work for the Portland Development Commission, they use condemnation for acquiring property for urban renewal projects, but there is a reluctance by the commission, the Portland Development Commission, to do that, and typically it's condemnation as a last resort, and in some cases they will actually go into an urban renewal area and sample the residents as to their views on condemnation, and if people choose not to have condemnation applied, then the resolution of the commission will be adopted without a condemnation power. So they can do it either way, but it's I would say relatively infrequent, depending on public projects and whether all the property can be acquired voluntarily.
Thank you much, Senator Ringo.
My father has a story he still tells where he was part of the duck club that had the game refuge on all three sides down south of Corvallis, and his private land stuck out into the game refuge, and the folks who ran the refuge were just angry because the duck hunting was so good. And that's the real reason they took away the land. And so they condemned the land, took it away, but they didn't compensate him at the quality of duck hunting that it was. Just his average farmland.
Well, and he should have been, I think. Had I been the judge, I would have granted that. Anyway, okay. Great. Thank you. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Other questions by the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Council.
If I could just note for the committee, with respect to both the concern that government be able to exercise its condemnation power in a reasonable manner and the concern that property owners get compensation, I would just direct you to page 2 of the handout, and you'll see at the bottom a list of the members of the committee who worked on this bill and the other three bills. And you'll notice that not only are a number of firms represented who would be representing the usually the condemnees, the parties that are having their land condemned, but also you'll see that ODOT was there. Somebody from both the city attorney's office from Portland and Salem was there, and somebody from DOJ. And then there were interested participants. You'll see that Brad Swank of the court system was there as well. So I just wanted to point that out for everybody to know kind of who were the players involved.
Right. Good. And there are no amendments to this bill, correct? All right. Committee, are we happy? Thrilled? Work session.
Chairman.
Senator Brick. Senator Brick moves House Bill 3370 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection?
Just, Mr. Chair, I just want to state that condemnation is a necessary evil of law.
Emphasis on evil.
Yeah. I mean, we can't help it. Sometimes it just needs to be done. And
this wasn't quite as interesting, though, as the law of a sheet.
No.
But, okay. All right. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? There are no objections. Motion passes. Senator Birdie, would you be so kind as to carry this fine piece of legislation. All right. Next up on our hit parade. You know what I want to do? I don't know if anybody wants to. Lieutenant Gower is having a goodbye thing down at 3:50 as we speak. So I think I'm going to recess for just 10 minutes. I can get you guys to come back. If you want to go down there and say hey and goodbye and whatever. So
yeah.
We do that. So we'll recess.
What round is that?
3:50. I think it should just run the corner.
Yeah, just
run. So if you want to go say hey and
yeah, he's a cutie. We're going to miss him.
Well, he's just going to go to the Department of Corrections.
I know.
Several possibilities. Duke.